before we begin, I think just to get the mood set for the symbolism in art, I'm going to read a couple of sentences from a book that I really like and use a lot in my work. And it's called The Signs and Symbols in Christian Art. It's by George Ferguson. I use several different books on the symbolism of art, but I like this one the best because it's small, it's a little paperback, and it's grouped according to different types of art symbols, such as the animal symbols or the flower symbols and the colors and so forth. So it's real easy to work with. And this would be available in almost all Christian, almost all bookstores that have any section on art or Christian art. And I like the definition that they have of symbolism in here. The Christian asserts that man is created in the image of God. He declares that God has given man a soul capable of reaching up into heaven itself and inspiring the human mind to its noblest achievement in quest after God. It is the spiritual aspiration that lifts man to his highest and greatest heights. No words have ever been found that are adequate to give a satisfactory expression. There is a reason for this. God has given the soul the privilege of enjoying a continuous awareness of the realities of life. These realities may be described as the never-ending experiences man has with truth, beauty, and goodness. These experiences are so vital and so moving that man has a constant urge to impart them to others. It is this sharing, this act of sharing them, which gives witness to the truth that he is indeed made in the image of God. There is a language for these experiences. It is a very simple and very beautiful language which man has known and used since the beginning of time. It is called the language of the sign and the symbol. And I'm sure that every one of you here have had many experiences where you've seen a piece of art, or maybe have heard some music that was so moving for you. There was so much either sorrow or truth or goodness or beauty in this work that you hardly could express it. Would any of you like to share some type of a art form that you have seen in recent years that has done this to you? About a month ago, I'll share an experience I had. About a month ago, we had an exhibit at the museum where I worked, Minneapolis Institute of Art, and it was an exhibit on 16th century textiles. And I've taken a couple of weaving courses, so I have just a vague knowledge of how much work and what's involved in these huge, huge textiles. They had had the gallery for this, these textiles were on display, completely redone, the repainting and redoing the interior of these galleries just to have them fit for these huge textiles. And on a Sunday afternoon, we had an hour program there where we had a quartet that was playing on 16th century instruments, and the docent of the textile, or the curator of the textile department, explained what was taking place in these textiles. And you know, sitting in that gallery and around all these textiles and hearing this 16th century music played on these period instruments, it was just a real, real moving experience for me to be, you know, experiencing that. So, would yes.
We were at a Holocaust one of the prisons where prison camps, mm-hmm. and they had an art piece outside of that, and you couldn't help but be so moved mm. by that.
Was this in Eastern Europe?
Outside of Munich.
Yeah.
And people just stood around there in awe.
And they just probably couldn't talk.
And it was so quiet. The atmosphere created the sense of quiet.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And we, I've seen a second time Frank Lloyd Wright's Phantom of the Opera.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, the music, the setting, the stage, the color, as it is as an art form, I guess you'd say. Just the, not like the music, the drama. The scenery. It's just spectacular. Just imagine.
Well, I think what we'll do then is go right on with the slides. And if you have any questions you'd like to ask, I do have a lot. We probably won't be able to get through them all, but I think it's more important that we stop and take care of questions if you have, or if you have any comment, and we'll do what we're able to do in this 45 minutes. We're going to start with a 14th century piece because I think it's such a wonderful example of symbolism in art. This is called The Madonna and a Child. And what we're seeing here is a little triptych. This isn't a very large piece. Is there anyone here? I see a couple of people that were to the first lecture I gave on Christian art. Okay, well, this is just about where we were finishing up. And up until that time, you were seeing almost all large pieces that were painted right on the walls of the chapels themselves. You know, they were either frescoes or mosaics or altar pieces that were very large. And this is one of the first pieces that we're going to see that is a small piece to be used in a home altar. And this is, we're just beginning now to see art being brought actually into the home, Christian art being brought into the home rather than in the cathedrals and in the large churches. This is called a triptych. It has three panels, as you can see. The two outer panels would close. And so, and it's not a very big piece. We have this at the Minneapolis Institute where I work, and it's only about so big. And so these two outer would close, so when you weren't having a little private chapel or a little service of your own or wanting to meditate, you could keep them closed and keep the dust from getting on the images themselves. And when you close it, there is an interesting painting on the outside too, but not with all this beautiful gold leaf that you see here. This is actual gold leaf, and it is called the Madonna and Child. We can see they are definitely, because of the size and so forth, the focal point with some of the saints around. It's just filled with symbolism. We see here a Saint Francis receiving the stigmata from this Christ. The Annunciation at the top here, Gabriel and Mary. The crucifixion here. At that point, the 14th century Italy, and this was in Florence, Italy, they weren't using much of a landscape in any of the paintings yet. We're just beginning to see a little landscape right here. But most of the Christian art would have had this type of a gold background. In the room where we have this at the museum, we refer to it as our gold room because it is medieval Christian art. And all of the pieces of art in that room do have this kind of a gold background. And at sometimes the day, it's just absolutely brilliant in that room with the reflection and the feeling of all this gold.
Carol, what accounts for the emergence of landscape into the art? Here. Is there, I mean, is it somehow connected with St. Francis, or?
Well, I think that this is very symbolic for this region because it was done, the name of the artist is Dotti, and he had such a demand for these in Florence. By the mid-14th century, you know, Florence was a very wealthy city. They were the major banking city for all of Europe. And there was such a demand for these home altars, and we're just, you know, as I said, just beginning to see these, that he actually had to set up an assembly line to use, to make them, to meet the demand. And this is the first time that I've mentioned an artist's name, too, for those that were in the last time. We didn't talk about artist's name because we're just beginning to have artist's names used and kept with a piece of art now. St. Francis, of course, practiced his preaching. This isn't too far from Assisi. And so he was very, very influential in that area. And in the late 13th century, early 14th century, St. Francis was very, very often seen in art. He was a real loved saint. But for the reason of having the landscape, and I don't have an opportunity to develop that this morning, when I do a tour of Christian art at the museum, I show this and talk about the beginning of, we're just beginning to see landscape. And we haven't seen that for 1,000 years in art. And we're going to move more and more into more and more landscape. You'll see that a little bit as we progress today. I can't take you through the whole progression. But the artists at this time did not look at nature. They did not look at other human beings to develop their art. Rather, they studied other art forms. And since the art for Christian art was this Byzantine style with a gold background, they just continued to use it over and over and over. And in a couple of hundred years, when you get to the northern artists, they're really going to look at nature. Yes?
That's all painted. There's no carving or?
No.
It's all flat.
And of course, this is carved around here. And those little hinges back here, so you can close it up.
So it's
and it's
deep.
Done on wood.
It's not deep.
Nope. It's very shallow. And I got a close-up when we talk about the symbolism of the Madonna and Child. And you can see it's the pretty flat face, that Byzantine, almost icon look. I wanted to discuss the symbolism here of these colors because we usually see Mary in with a red undergarment and the blue mantle. And these are her colors, red being the passion color and blue being heaven. And of course, we see a lot of gold, which also symbolizes the importance of heaven. And that's why we had all the gold background rather than the blue sky. It was the power and so forth of heaven. Christ here is still looking like kind of a little man, but he's a lot more pleasant than what we left off at 2 days ago. I mean, he's smiling now, and he has a kind of, you know, full little cheeks, and Mary here has got some fullness to her. She's got these almond eyes that are very Byzantine, and the halos, of course, are symbolic of Christ and Mary.
Carol, how common were things like this in the home when you said they were in the home?
Yes, well, of course, when we think of the 14th and 15th century, we have a group that are very wealthy. But it's only in the very wealthy homes that you would find this. Because, you know, with all this gold leaf, and this is all real gold, which you're seeing here, you can understand that it would be too costly unless they had a great deal of wealth. So even if it's a small piece, it's still a pretty costly piece. I'm moving back a couple of centuries here just because I wanted to show you the evangelists in their symbols. This is 9th century Germany, and you see the four evangelists here, each one writing their gospels. But here we see Matthew, and Matthew is symbolic of a man image with wings. Over here we see John. And John is always symbolized as being an eagle with the wings. And then down here we see the lion, and that is Mark. And then the oxen would be Luke. 17th century Spain. This is an El Greco painting of St. Peter. And the symbolism of St. Peter is very often holding the keys to heaven. And we see St. Peter here holding the keys. century Italy, a Titian painting. Titian was an artist that did a lot of work in Venice. If you've been to Venice, you've probably seen a lot of Titian and Tintoretto work. I wanted to show Mary Magdalene because it is so symbolic of when we see her work, that she is exposed as having her blouse or her top garment kind of falling off her shoulder. In other words, she's kind of showed like a prostitute. And her hair is usually long and flowing and kind of wrapped around her. The poor artists have done, or the artists have done a lot of giving Mary Magdalene a bad rap, I think, when it comes to art. A little later, we will see her as more of a penitent sinner, and then she actually, during the time of the Reformation, you see Mary Magdalene with a little halo on, because this is the time when they're looking at the sinners as going through this penitence, and so they use her in a different way a few hundred years later. Okay, this is one that many of you have seen at Christmas time. It's a Fra Angelico, 14th century in Italy. About working about the same time that Dada, the one I showed you first, this of the triptych. And so again, we see that gold background with just the touch of landscape coming in to it. What I wanted to show you here basically is how we're seeing Christ. We're seeing him for the first time that I've shown, you know, I showed all these slides up to the year 1500 last time. Christ was always looking like kind of a little man of wisdom. And here now we see Christ looking as a real little baby. In fact, the humanism that was developing, the general philosophy of humanism in the world that was developing at this time, this is after St. Francis' teaching, after Thomas Aquinas, so we're getting this concern for Christianity is taking on a more human attitude and development. And they wanted to make sure that we all understand that this little Christ child is really human. So the artist, if you could have a real close-up of the baby itself, you would see that he is indeed a real little baby boy. And the straw around is just a gold bed with the halo again. The colors are red for Passion on Mary. Even Joseph has the red and the blue this time. I've mentioned before about the real gold being used in the background here. If you could be up close to this little painting, you'd see actual little gold threads in Mary's gown. Now we know that Mary and Joseph were not able to afford this kind of clothing. So we're going to see as we develop now the next few centuries, they're really idolizing and making her dressed as the woman of the day, as of the period that this would be. And this would very likely be the kind of a dress that a 14th century well-to-do woman would be wearing. The other attributes here, the little angel sitting over the nativity scene, are blue with the color attributed to heaven. The oxen and the donkey here are usually always seen in the nativity scene. Here they're actually even kneeling, and this is a symbol of humility because the of the lowliest of animals, and Christ being born in this very humble environment. But it's kind of interesting that with very beautiful fabrics and a lot of costly materials showing also. Now we're moving up to 15th century Flemish art. And again, we see Mary dressed as a 15th century young teenage woman with very costly materials on. We're seeing the setting of the Annunciation taking place in a Flemish home of an upper middle or upper class environment. Gabriel is usually an attribution for Gabriel is the lily, and either the archangel will be carrying this in the hand when he comes to Mary for the Annunciation, or it will be between Mary and the angel. And in this case, they've gotten it put into a Delft pot or pitcher, which is also made right there in the Netherlands. Mary, we very frequently in the Annunciation scene will see her reading. Again, now we're quite sure that Mary did not have the literary ability to read, but we almost always see the Annunciation with her holding a book. Other interesting things of symbolism here is the candle that we associate with many different symbols in the Christian church. She's got her colors with red for passion, with this her blue outer garment being just kind of flung across her seat here. This is also a triptych, and it was used as an altarpiece. We don't know who the artist is here, but the two outer panels, the man and the woman that are kind of peeking in the door here at the Annunciation scene, are the people who donated this altarpiece to the church. They're the donors. And at this time, we see the donors very often. They want to have their pictures included. It's sort of like today when somebody gives a lot of money to have a wing built on a building, you know, they have their name on that wing. Well, the donors, occasionally we'll see the donors right in the center, but normally they do let the images of the triune God be in the center and take a little side position themselves. Notice now we're up in Northern Europe and they're really using and looking at how people looked in depicting. I told you that up till about the 14th, 15th century in Southern Europe, they were looking at all other images, and so there was just kind of a repeat and repeat and repeat of how Mary looked. But now we see a Flemish girl with red flowing hair. We see a real perspective with the landscaping and the city in the background here. This is an interesting panel because this is Joseph in his carpentry shop, and what he's making here is a mouse trap. And isn't that symbolic of what is ahead in the story of Christ?
How come there's always, I mean, at least in this picture, there's a big age difference between Joseph and Mary. I didn't.
Yeah, well, see, he's an old man here, and he's seen as a, you know, the young teenage woman that the archangel came to. Yeah. Just a close-up, so you can see the interior of the building. They really worked with a lot of realism and detail in the buildings, detail in the fabrics and so forth. I wanted you to be sure to see this Delft picture and the book. You can actually almost read the pages of that book.
Candle isn't lit, is it?
Smoke.
Smoke is
right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now we've seen two
different
paintings here.
At least two. Yeah, these are all, these last three, they were all done by the same artist, and they were all different triptychs, but now here you see the candle isn't this. They were done with the same interior and the same theme for different churches.
Is that in fact writing, or if you blow it up enough, is there really writing there?
I think there would be. You know, it just amazes me. I'm going to show you some more in just a second, that you almost think they would have to work with magnifying glasses to produce this kind of art. These northern artists were so detailed with nature. This is another triptych, and this was done for the city of Bruges, and we can see the city in the background. Now, it's interesting here that we don't see as many attributes to Mary. Of course, we know who Jesus is. It is Mary holding Jesus, but rather than being in her usual attire, she's dressed like a nun of the day. We think this is Mary Magdalene. She doesn't have, again, her usual attributes with her. But usually at the crucifixion scene, or at the, here it's the Pietà because the Christ has been taken down from the cross. But usually it's Mary Magdalene and John the Apostle that are seen. So we think that is who these two are. We think this is Joseph of Arimathea, whose tomb Jesus was buried in. Because of Joseph of Arimathea was supposedly a wealthy man, and obviously this man has a great deal of wealth. You can tell that by the way he's dressed. And we think these two are the donors. We have this at the museum, and I just love to see it. It's quite large. It's about the size of this screen. And when you close these two outer panels, in just gray and white tones is the Annunciation scene. So just the panel, you know, just it being closed is nice, very nice in itself. This is John the Baptist, and over here, St. Catherine. I have a couple of close-ups I want to show you of this. Limewood. Limewood, uh-huh. I wanted you just to examine the beautiful, beautiful fabric here. And this brocade would have actually, the fabric itself would have been made with gold threads. And so they have painted, you almost can see each little stitch put into this brocade. And on the hat detail, you can't see this here, I don't believe, but if you ever had an opportunity to see this in the Minneapolis Institute of Art, and we usually always have it up, there's a little tear on Mary's cheek. We can barely see a tear right here, I think, on John's.
Where was this done?
This was done in Flanders, at Bruges. This is the city of Bruges in the background, and actually just as it appeared at that time. Pardon? They do have a real Oriental look, definitely, especially Jesus.
Yeah.
You know, even the color of his skin. Mm-hmm. The almond type of eyes. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that those triptychs were always, you know, mentioned somewhere in a home? Could that have been in a, we'll say, a chapel?
This was done for a church in Bruges.
Where's Bruges?
It's in what it was at that time in the Netherlands, and now it's in Brussels, isn't it?
In Belgium.
It's
in Belgium.
Belgium.
Do you know who the artist was?
No. And we call it the Master of St. Lucy because he did so many for a chapel that was called the Lucy Chapel. When we aren't able to identify the artist, but we know the kind of work that they did at that time, they oftentimes are called the master of so-and-so. The next one I show you is also just considered to be a master because we don't know the actual. It may have been done because it was such a large piece. It could have been done where there were a number of people working under the master too. Now, this is northern cities, and one of the ways it made its wealth was with the weavings. And so you see that they wanted to really emphasize that with those beautiful fabrics. You can see the beautiful fabrics on St. Catherine. Also, the other attributes of her is her crown. She was holding a sword. You can just see the bit of the sword here. And St. Catherine was supposedly a very learned person, and so she oftentimes is seen with a book. She was also came from Catherine? A wealthy family.
Which Catherine is this?
Yes, this is Catherine that she was born in Alexandria, Egypt. So we're going way back.
Yeah.
And she was Christian. She was from a noble family, and one of the rulers of the day wanted to marry her because she was supposedly a very, very beautiful and very learned person. But he wasn't Christian, and he wouldn't become Christian, and so she refused to marry him, and he had her killed, and this is why she's been sainted.
So this sounds like Saint Lucia.
Yeah.
I had a question.
If you'd like to look up, say in my book here, whatever happened to it, we can look St. Catherine up and get a full.
So you said St. Catherine is from Alexandria?
Yes. Mm-hmm. But now she's shown with very Flemish color hair. Yeah, you can look St. Catherine up under the saints there. She's shown here with very Flemish.
Was she a patron of? Patron saint of Bruges?
Maybe. No, I don't think so. I think he's checking her out. There's a section called saints in there. I wanted to show you John the Baptist, a detail of him. He does have a rather nice outer cloak on him, but underneath there is the camel here, which is usually seen with John the Baptist. And down below here is a dandelion. We can see the one of the dandelions has gone to seed. And the dandelion is oftentimes shown it represents bitter herbs. So it's oftentimes shown at the crucifixion. Another one of John the Baptist. This is El Greco, 16th century Spain. In here, we definitely can see the camel here. Again, barefoot. Other attributes with John the Baptist, he oftentimes will be holding a cross made from reeds, which goes back to the symbolism of water, and then the lamb. And all of these are here. Madonna in the landscape. 15th century Brussels. We again see her now with her red color, the color of passion. And the detail here is very much like the one I just showed you from Flanders or Bruges. The Madonna here, if she was standing up, would be about 8 feet tall. she's sitting on a little ledge here in the Garden of Paradise, but she's very, very large for the area that she's sitting in. Christ here, the color is that he has on, white for purity. Again, she's reading a book. And almost everything in this painting is symbolic. The iris here is considered to be, because the shape of the iris, it's called the sword lily, and its symbolism of sorrow. We see a little violet here. There's other little violets here. I think I've got a close-up of some of these. Violets, because they grow so close to the ground, are humble. Here we see a close-up. The The many plants, again, are signs of sorrow, and that goes way back to pagan times. Look at the beautiful fabric on the little pill. This is another one we have at the Institute, and we just recently got it, and we don't know the artist for this either. It's called, the artist is called the Master of Embroidery Foliage, because the foliage is so beautiful. Peacock is symbolic of eternity, because the flesh, or immortality, because the flesh is this old legend that the flesh of a peacock never deteriorates. You can see why the artist is called the Artist of Embroidery Foliage. The stags are symbolic of piety and religious aspiration, because the stag seeks freedom and refuge in the high mountains. We see here the stumps of these trees, the tree of life, which has been cut down and fashioned into the cross of Christ for the crucifixion.
Did you say
one's
for piety and what was the other thing?
For the stags? Yeah. Religious aspiration.
Thank you.
Is there any symbolism between the peacock being on the gate, kind of between the sword, you know, the iris of suffering and the dandelion moving into paradise?
Oh, it could be. I haven't known. I haven't read about that, but it very likely could be. Quite often you'll see the peacock even at the nativity scene, the time that Christ is born. Mm-hmm. Another Annunciation scene. This is another one that we have at the Institute, and we call this the little balm baby. balm baby, because we haven't seen God featured very much before, up until about the 15th, 16th century, and this is 16th century Italy. And we do see God here as a grandfather in this heavenly scene, and dropping down the Holy Spirit in the form of the dove. And of course, Gabriel, the archangel, comes flying into this room with his lily, and telling Mary what is in store for her. But so that we all really understand this picture, you see, they've got this little Christ child coming right down as a real little baby. And again, Mary in the colors that we've talked about before, and you can see she's at a lectern here reading. This is in the setting that is very likely 16th century Italy. And we hadn't seen God before, so I thought that I'd put in a couple of how he was featured about this time. The one we saw was 16th century Italy. This is 16th century Germany, and this is a woodcut by Dürer. He always signed his artwork with his symbols. You can see this was done in 1511, his initials, A with a D. This is a woodcut that we have at the museum also. We see the Trinity here, God, Christ, and the Holy
Spirit. AD is not on your video?
No. Pardon?
No. It's Albert Dürer.
Okay,
Albert.
Just the AD as well.
Oh, no, it's Albert Dürer. And he always signs his work like this, and it's nice because we always know exact year that it was done. He did a lot. He did a lot of work. Well, I put this one in just because there is so much symbolism here. This would be after the Reformation in Germany. So sometimes it's referred to as Counter-Reformation, mm-hmm. when they were having a lot of miracles shown in Christian art. Of course, after the Reformation, art was in many areas in Northern Europe was stripped from the churches. And so the Protestants weren't using a lot of art. But the Catholics were using very theatrical art at this time, almost like they're trying to draw people back into the church. Mm-hmm. And it was almost done in propaganda form. This is the Immaculate Conception, title of this. It's also one that we have. And I'm just going to read a little bit about all this symbolism because there is so much here. It comes from Revelations 12:1, where the Immaculate Conception is based on that verse that says, "A woman clothed with the sun and with the moon under her feet, in her crown of 12 stars." The sun represents the presence of Christ, and the moon is also an attribute to Mary based on the biblical verse. It's also an ancient symbol of chastity. Now, we can only see a few of the stars. We see there are 12 stars, and they're to represent the 12 tribes, or the 12 apostles, and thus also the people of the church. And we see 6 stars in the foreground, and the other 6 are behind Mary's head. We see the angels playing here, violins, lutes, triangles. And so you can imagine if this was in a Baroque church and you had this Baroque music anyway, how really symbolic the whole thing would be. And she's got her arms outspread, you know, welcoming the worshipers with her usual colors. And they're reminding us that the congregation, the worshipers, would be people of a lower status. We see 2 of the patron saints here that really talked a lot about Mary during their preaching times. This is Saint Francis and this Saint Anthony, both of the Franciscan order. We can recognize Saint Francis with type of clothing that they have on, but also he's got this cord belt, and that we oftentimes would see with St. Francis, and there's 3 knots here, and these are the 3 vows he took for chastity, obedience, and poverty. And St. Anthony, if we had a close-up of this, we could see a book by his gown. And then also with St. Francis, they oftentimes will show the lily and the skull. And this is that man, of course, is not going to live forever, the immortality of man. Another one of St. Francis, we see some of the same symbols here, the 3 knots again on his cord, the skull with the crucifixion. This is El Greco, the painter is El Greco in 16th century Spain. Oh, I didn't bring down my Bible, and I wanted to read just a couple of paragraphs here from Daniel. And that page all found in my Bible back in my room. Got a little off last night, but I had to start to put a couple together here. Well, I think rather than trying to find it and read them, I'll just tell you what I want to do before we see the next slide. This is of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar, who we know he had these dreams, and he went to Daniel and wanted Daniel to interpret his dream. And Daniel was very hesitant to do so and finally said, "Well, I have to tell you that if what your dream represents is that you're showing too much interest in all the wealth of you're the ruler of Babylon, and you're showing so much interest in all this wealth and in your power and in your greatness, and that you're going to be sent out to live in the wilderness with the animals and with the shrubs if you don't repent in your ways and be more gracious with your your wealth. And Nebuchadnezzar didn't, and then indeed God did have him go out to in the wilderness. And what we see here then is an 18th example of William Blake's interpretation of what happened to Nebuchadnezzar when he went into the wilderness. And the part that I wanted to read in the Bible says that in the dream, it was interpreted by Daniel that he would actually grow claws on his feet like birds, wild birds, and that he would grow so much hair that he would look like he'd have feathers on his body. And I think this is a real good example of showing the emotionalism of those.
You said this was the 18th?
This is 18th century English. 18th century English. I'm going now into some of the more contemporary art. And this was by William Blake.
What collection is this a part of, Carol? This is in.
And I don't know where this is located.
There should be a podiatrist's office.
If you'd like, if you would like to read the story, it's Daniel 4, 1 through 37. Did you find it? 4, 1 through, just read the very last 36, 37.
At the same time, my reason returned to me, and for the glory of my kingdom, my majesty and splendor returned to me. My counselors and my lords sought me, and I was established in my kingdom. And still more greatness was added to me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol the honor of the King of Heaven. For all his works are right, and his ways are just, and those who walk in his pride, he is able to abase.
The very end doesn't say about how he was going to be that.
That was the end of 4. That was 36 to 37 and 4.
Oh, the Bible, the one that I had at my room, talked about the.
Karen?
Little clause.
I'll look for it.
Okay. So I'm going to move now, that was the 18th century. I'm going to move now to a few of the 19th century. I have some of Van Gogh's work. Van Gogh was born to a in a family where the father was a pastor of the Dutch Reformed Church. He had developed a real deep religious convictions himself, but was never really able to express them. He planned to go into the field of ministry and actually did for a while, but very dissatisfied with his ability to express himself in the work that he had got into. So he felt his calling was to express himself in painting. And we can see here the title of this is The Potato Eaters. It was done in the earlier years of his painting in Holland. And what he's showing here is the thankfulness that these peasant people have for their simple meal of just eating potatoes. And we see a fair amount of emotionalism. And we're going to see more of this as we see Van Gogh develop into his work. Very emotional. There aren't very many symbols as we've been looking at all these symbols. We aren't going to see many symbols now in Christian art because we're illiterate people. We don't have to have the symbolisms to tell us a story. So we can work with such things as emotionalism and other ways of expressing the feeling. And Van Gogh oftentimes will use the blue and the yellow. We very, very often see that with Van Gogh's work. And here we see Mary with Christ. And Christ looks like Van Gogh. Mm-hmm. With this red hair.
Yes.
you people that have seen pictures of Van Gogh. So he himself, as you remember, he went through an awful lot of suffering and mental turmoil, eventually committed suicide. And having only sold one painting in his entire life, and now about a month ago, what was one of his paintings that was bought by the Anaheim family for the New York City Museum? $57 million for one painting?
Is Christ's ear missing there?
It looks like it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And that, you know. Yes. Yes. I'm glad you saw that.
Is this late? I don't think I've ever seen any like this. Is this late in his career?
It was. Well, yes, it was. Of course, his time wasn't very long.
Right.
You know, he didn't begin to paint until he was into his 30s, and he died in his early 40s, wasn't it? So the whole span of painting was just about 10, 12 years. Obviously, it must have been after he had cut off his ear. The Raising of Lazarus. And who we see here, again, we're seeing Christ, or Lazarus, in this case, like Van Gogh himself. And we don't see Christ coming here to the tomb, but we see Mary Magdalene flying in just as Christ is, or as Lazarus is rising.
Interesting to see the sun there, and she uses a lot.
Oh, yes.
Is there some symbolism that indicates that's Mary Magdalene?
We know that Mary was the one that led Jesus to the tomb of Lazarus from the biblical story.
I thought it would be Mary, Bethany, Mary and Martha.
Lazarus
was their brother.
Yes. We very often will see all three of them, and I don't have any other Raising of Lazarus with me right now. Yeah, this is the Good Samaritan.
Is that Van Gogh?
Yes. And this is one that we have in our collection at the museum. It's the olive trees. And when you read the background of how Van Gogh was feeling about the inspiration of these trees and painting it, he discusses in his letters to his brother that to him, this was the Garden of Gethsemane. And these, you know, twisted in trees, just showing the emotionalism through the brushwork. I'll show you a detail of this. Actually, it's a palette work. He's using probably just a palette rather than, or a knife rather than a brush here. Another French artist, this is 20th century, Rouault, and we also have this in our collection. It's the Crucifixion. This artist, and he was a Catholic, and did a lot of Christian artwork. Before he began painting, he was a master of stained glass, and I think you can really see that here. And his desire to express his Christian work was in emotionalism and just the way he chose his colors and how he applied them. I have one of his stained glass examples to show you, and this is a little chapel in France, 20th century. It's called the, it's in a, chapel where the altar is in honor of Saint Veronica, And Veronica, at the time of the, when Christ was going to the crucifixion, she supposedly stopped and wiped off some of the sweat on his face with her mantle, and the mantle or the veil-like piece that she had on her head was to take on the symbolism of Christ and the crucifixion afterwards. And so we're seeing here the cross on her headpiece. And this is a stained glass. This is stained glass. And Picasso's crucifixion, early or late 19th century, early 20th century Spain. This is in the National Museum in Paris. We can barely make out here Christ on the cross. What he wanted to emphasize here was just the pain and the agony that goes with the crucifixion scene.
Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah,
he's Don Quixote's the one that's piercing the side of Christ. You're a real alert group here.
Looks like somebody throwing dice.
Yes. Looks like dice or card game. Dice, I imagine. Oh, they're casting for the robe, I suppose. I haven't studied it that thoroughly.
Yeah, what is
it? And here we have, look at, here's the ladder scene.
Yeah.
So what is that, sunglasses or what?
Let's go back here.
It's my favorite boy.
Oh.
It's got turbos on.
Another Spanish artist, 20th century, and this is Dali. I think maybe you've seen this one before, as well as Dali's Last Supper. But I think, to me, it's really, really moving. Christ was seeing the perspective from the top, looking down at the time of the crucifixion and the world. Mm-hmm. And most of us have seen this Last Supper, which again is a really moving picture. I just put in the Last Supper that we're so familiar with, Leonardo da Vinci's 15th century Italy, and this is a fresco that's located in Milan, and it's in pretty bad shape right now. They had done restoration work to it, but it is deteriorated, as you can see.
Carol?
Yes.
What do you make of this? It's not the usual symbolism of the Trinity with the fingers, but rather the teaching finger, I think it's called a mudra or something.
The mudra?
The mudra. There's one in this picture, and there's one in the Dali of the last picture.
Oh, that's cool. Yes. Well, he's giving, I suppose he's giving his message to the disciples.
So it's a
in our early Christian art, we oftentimes see Christ as a teacher with his disciples.
Yeah.
And this is probably, it is that symbol. I don't know. I haven't studied that.
I mean, usually you get Jesus when
more of a blessing
born,
of a blessing symbol.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but now it's
giving the message to go out. Well, I just have a few more here, and we'll quickly get through these. I do want to get this one if we don't have time for any more. We all recognize this is the Abraham and Isaac story. This is a sketching done by Rembrandt. And Rembrandt worked with a lot of Old Testament stories, and he also worked with a lot of people who were quite old. He did very good portraits of old people and people with a lot of emotionalism. This is right at the time that Abraham's about to insert the knife, into Isaac's throat when the angel comes down and prevents him from doing so. So that is the story that we can see a piece of contemporary sculpture done in this country. If we don't get any further than this, this is a good one to close on. This is George Siegel, who is a contemporary sculptor working in our country. It's an older man, as we can see here, with a knife in his hand and a young man kneeling. His hands are bound. This is located at Kent State, and it was done to commemorate the killings of Kent State in May of, what was it, 1971? 70? When, you know, the students were protesting the Vietnam War.
You mean that's the time that the National Guard shot?
Yes. And this is the sculpture that is put there to commemorate that time. And it's telling these older people, these older politicians, are sending their young men off to war and are killing them.